Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quite on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. This episode is all about our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders. Who was Baron de Montesquieu, and how did his ideas influence America's founding fathers? Today we have two professors from the film, Paul Carice and Michael Zugert, who are here to answer that question and fix any Montesquieu perspectives we might have. Welcome to the show, and thanks for being on with us.
Thank you, Samantha.
Thank you, Samantha.
So, who was Montesquieu in brief?
Montesquieu was a minor nobility. He held the title of Baron de Montesquieu eventually in the southwest of France, born in the 17th century, lived to about the middle of the 18th century. And he in some ways was a traitor to his class. He was a philosopher who admired elements of republican government, even though he lived in a monarchy. He advocated for religious toleration, which the French monarchy had at one time supported for Protestants within Catholic France and then had turned away from. And he became a philosopher who was willing to question even very standard dimensions of his own life, of the nobility, of the monarchy. In the end, he values the principle, the philosophical principle of moderation, being aware of extremes in thought and in political practice. And this whole package, as it turns out, becomes the single most important philosophy for the American framers at the time of deciding what kind of a national or federal constitutional order we needed.
There's really a remarkable effect that I think we might begin with, which is to say that the chief supporters of the Constitution, the people known as the Federalists, and the chief opponents of the Constitution, the people known as the Anti-Federalists, both looked to Montesquieu as a major authority for their position. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that. That seems so strange. And give us some insight into how that could be.
It's very helpful, Michael. The one element of Montesquieu's philosophy is that after almost 30 years of writing a few philosophical works, his final work is called The Spirit of the Laws. It's about 700 pages in translation. It's almost encyclopedic. It covers so many topics about human affairs and politics and culture and religion and laws, obviously. So one can find a great many points of view in it. And so people on different sides of the same, statesmen on different sides of the same political question might find a passage here or a passage there. But it also reflects this moderation idea. He's looking for balance. So we know Montesquieu as important for our Constitution, and the two most obvious influences are the separation of powers, distribution of powers, and federalism. Both are about balance, not taking one idea or one power too far, but balancing ideas and powers against each other. So in The Spirit of Laws, this large work, he is an advocate of republican liberty and the virtues and kind of civic character needed for that. But he's also an advocate of large federal republics. He says good things about how monarchies can be moderate. And he's generally against despotism or bloody or extreme oppressive politics. So in that package, the Americans can find strong arguments for this point of view or that point of view, and then they have to argue with each other. Well, given our context, I should say that's one other dimension of it. He's a little bit different from Locke and some other Enlightenment philosophers in that he's very aware of the need for judgment or prudence by statesmen. He believes in a universal set of principles of natural law or natural right, but it's not the main theme of The Spirit of Laws. Having stated his belief in such principles, he emphasizes that culture and geography and religion and history and a whole range of factors. That's the spirit of laws. All of these factors coming together to make sense of the laws of a given country or place. All those have to be understood by statesmen in a particular place to decide how to live up to universal principles of right in this particular situation. And so, of course, I think Montesquieu would be very happy to know that American statesmen, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, are citing him and arguing and disagreeing because he said, well, that's what they would need to do in that particular context.
Yeah. Very helpful, I think, Paul. But so which of them do you think had the better of the argument, had the better grasp of Montesquieu as applied in their circumstances?
It's arguable that in the circumstances, the Articles of Confederation was an attempt to abide by, I'll say, two dimensions. The Lockean idea that government must be based in consent of the governed to be legitimate, and probably the legislature is the best branch to ensure the government is living up to consent of the governed. The Articles does that. And then the Montesquieuan idea the Anti-Federalists or advocates of the Articles are making is that republics have to be small. So you know, it's hard to make a large federal republic. But by the mid-1780s, important people, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and then lesser known people, but very significant people in the Congress, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, are saying, this is just not working. This Articles, this very minimal government. And so then the other dimensions of Montesquieu come into play, suggesting that a confederal, or but really a federal republic, a republic of republics, could have great advantages, could leave liberty in small republics while still having a large enough republic to be a real nation and able to defend itself in international affairs. And then his ideas about the British Constitution reconfigured. It's not exactly the British Constitution in historical practice, but the sort of an idealized version of the British Constitution gives a model for the Americans to use. You can have three separate powers and you have a bicameral legislature. And so arguably the Federalists come up with a rhetorical and philosophical package, especially as Publius, right? Hamilton and Madison and Jay, to say, this is what America needs right now in these circumstances. And it has a bright prospect into the future. And the Anti-Federalists cite Montesquieu, but can't quite put together a package on drawing on Montesquieu or anybody else that can adequately persuade or adequately respond to the Federalist argument.
On that note, which founding fathers cited Montesquieu the most?
Go ahead, Michael.
That's a good question. It's not clear that there's a clear answer to that because many of them cited Montesquieu. I don't think there's anybody who stands out for having cited him extraordinarily more than others. But some of the leading ones cited him. So, for example, in the Federalist Papers, both Hamilton and Madison cite Montesquieu. They both cite him as a great authority. That is, Hamilton in one of the Federalist Papers cites Montesquieu as the guide to understanding Federalism. Madison cites Montesquieu in another Federalist paper as the guide for understanding separation of powers. So it isn't so much a matter even of how often they cite him, it's a matter of with what authority they cite him. That is, in those two cases, that's a good example. On the other side, the Anti-Federalist Brutus, for example, one of the leading Anti-Federalist writers, cites Montesquieu as a great authority on this theme that Paul just mentioned, that is the small republic and the need for a republic to remain small and the need for a regime to be actually a proper republic in order to remain free, because I think the Anti-Federalists, just like the Federalists, had liberty as their chief goal, and they understood liberty and the small republic to be closely related to each other. Likewise, Federal Farmer, another one of the very prominent Anti-Federalist writers, looked at Montesquieu as a great authority. So it's hard to identify who cited him the most, but it's clear that the people we would consider the leading members, the leading debaters, so to speak, in the debate over the Constitution, those people cited him as this great authority. And I think that was what's most significant, most interesting about that.
Well, one of the other interesting dimensions is that we know from Madison's notes of the Federal Convention, Constitutional Convention in 1787, that these delegates are mentioning Montesquieu, and even when not citing his name, very Montesquieuan ideas about a constitution and about federalism. And one presumes they didn't travel to Philadelphia with large libraries of books, you know, so he's just in the air, and his name will be invoked at certain points as an authority. There are very few invocations of him in that federal convention to say, you know, Montesquieu's got it all wrong. We don't want to follow
him. All right.
But he's cited to say, well, this is an authority, and I will invoke him. One other prominent mention to the list that Michael gave us is in Federalist number 78, which happens to be written by Hamilton, about the independent judiciary. And this is a real innovation for the Americans, but it's also an innovation in Montesquieu, by Montesquieu in his political philosophy. Locke had given the idea of separation of or distribution of powers a great endorsement by saying it's absolutely essential for legitimate government to prevent a government from becoming self-interested or tyrannical and not serving the consent of the governed. But his was a simpler model. It was basically a distribution into a legislative power and an executive power. The legislative power was a single house of a legislature. And some of the new American state constitutions after 1776 followed that model. Montesquieu makes the argument that the English Constitution has a genius for liberty, the only constitution in the world devoted to liberty, precisely because it distributes the powers across three independent branches, legislature, executive, and judicial.
Yeah. One of the other interesting and really hard points for the Americans in drawing their constitution, Montesquieu, when he developed his picture of the English Constitution, which the Americans, by the way, all admired, or almost all of them anyway, admired very much. But there was one difference between, one big, big difference between what Montesquieu developed in his picture of the English Constitution and the American situation, and that was this. The Montesquieuian model, based on the actual reality of the British Constitution, saw the British Constitution as an example of something called the mixed regime. This is a familiar idea to many, but just to go quickly over it, the mixed regime is the idea that a proper political society, a stable and just political society, is one that's going to mix the major regime elements from the different pure regimes. So the pure regimes would be a monarchy, an aristocracy, a democracy, as, say, in Aristotle's discussion of politics. And what Montesquieu says is that the separation of powers requires mixing together the idea of separating functions, that is, legislative, judicial, and executive, mixing that or mingling that in a way with the mixed regime, that is, the mix of monarchic, aristocratic, and democratic elements. So Montesquieu sees the proper separation of power system as one with a monarch, preferably hereditary, one with a House of Lords, that is an aristocratic body, and one with a democratic body. The problem that the Americans faced was we didn't have a monarch and we didn't have an aristocracy. And the question that they faced was, can you develop the proper kind of institutional competences on the one hand, and can you develop the proper kind of separateness of institutions on the other without those different kind of regime elements that Montesquieu had relied on? And here's where the creativity of the Americans seemed particular, well, one place anyway, where it seemed particularly important. Paul, maybe
Yes, that's brilliant, Michael. He, again, in the package of his political philosophy, The Spirit of Laws, he does say regularly, he shouldn't go into too much detail because, of course, the details are what matters for particular statesmen in particular places. You'll have to figure this out. And the Americans do figure this out. There's a passage in the Spirit of Laws where he refers to the British Constitution as a republic cloaked under the form of a monarchy. That this is how the English political constitutional order had developed over centuries. And the Americans interpret this to say, well, gee, maybe you can blend some monarchical elements into a republic, because given the Declaration of Independence, you couldn't have any kind of an official aristocracy, nobility, monarchy. It has to be, the Publius in the Federalist says this over and over again, this is a republican form of government. But Montesquieu himself gives plenty of evidence of republicans not able to be properly balanced and stable. They don't really have a distribution of powers. Republics aren't known for that. Maybe the Roman Republic, but that's not quite the picture that Montesquieu emphasizes. So the Americans have to kind of use their own judgment and make it up. We're going to take some monarchical elements, say an upper house of a legislature, right? Not just a lower house, so to speak. Say a single executive that has a long term, immediately the anti-federalists charge this is the fetus of monarchy, or even in the convention. And then, as we were mentioning, the judges, to have a small number of lawyers having pretty substantial power seems like what a nobility would have in a monarchy. So the Americans make the argument, well, this blending of some elements we discover in monarchy and nobility, but not serving here anything like a monarchy, we can blend them in and it will all be better for it.
One of the things that, Paul, you've emphasized in your comments on Montesquieu that certainly is important, which is his, as people now speak of it, his particularism. That is, he seems to see that suitable to different places are different kind of regimes. He doesn't want to put forward, at least not in the same way that Locke did, one model of what the best regime is. So some critics of Montesquieu, picking up on that aspect of his thought, accuse him of being relativist. Does that seem correct? Is that right?
I will point out, though, that the anti-federalists, who are all advocates of liberty, do want some of that flexibility that Montesquieu is talking about in his political philosophy, right? That we believe in principles of universal right, but we know enough to know that maybe one size doesn't fit all. So this is what the anti-federalists are looking for. They want the small republics in the American, to them, confederation or federal republic to have more authority to maintain their distinct ways of shaping the laws and shaping life. And there are large regional differences from north to middle to south in the United States. So they want that flexibility. While they wouldn't claim they were being relativist for doing it.
Was the idea of the independent judiciary the most radical idea that Montesquieu proposed?
Is it the most radical idea he proposed? I'd say it's a very important innovation that Montesquieu proposed. And in my earlier comment, I tried to emphasize why I think that's so, which is he systematizes the English jury. He wants to say the intervention of the people, the intervention of a group of representatives of the people, are the best guarantee for the rule of law, because the people are going to make sure, or at least they're more likely to make sure than anybody else, that the government is acting under law rather than acting arbitrarily or with favor any sort of bias. So for Montesquieu, it's the jury that is the guarantor, really, of the rule of law. And an independent judiciary, I think, is the one sine qua non of a pretty good political society. Paul, you want to add something to that? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll turn your question around a little bit, Samantha. I would say a bold idea that he has after Machiavelli and Hobbes and Locke and Voltaire, a bold idea he has is to be a little less radical in your philosophy, to be a little more aware of the complexity of human beings and of politics. And so don't have your one big idea, or maybe your two big ideas. So the paradox is he has a big idea, which is moderation. And then everyone tries to figure out, well, what exactly does that mean? But this idea of, you know, he says at one point very clearly, the political good is always found between two extremes. And he says in multiple places, you can take any good idea or good dimension of life to an extreme. You can go too far with it. Even reason, even philosophy, he says. So the bold idea he has is to say, you really do need this package, this idea of spirit of laws. You can't just talk about the laws. You can't just talk about culture. You can't just talk about religion. You can't just talk about economics. You can't just talk about, I don't know, climate, right? You've got to talk about, if you're a philosopher and a statesman, you have to consider all of these dimensions. And then, of course, as we've been talking, that fits with his main constitutional recommendation. If you want a decent, moderate form of government, I don't care if you're a monarchy or a republic or whatever, you need to have a balance and distribution of powers. And then if you're a republic, the reality of the world is you can't be a republic unless you're relatively small. But you're not going to survive in this world, especially with lots of monarchies and empires around, unless you can become a federal republic, unless you can become a republic of republics. But that too is this idea of balance. You know, you got to make, in effect, you got to make compromises. You can't just emphasize one idea or one view of what's right. Again, I think he does have very clear views of fundamental ideas of natural law and natural right, and what is despotic and unjust government and what is decent and moderate government. But it's this view that the package of human life and human affairs is so complex that you need this whole balance. And then how to do it the right way in a particular time and place is up to statesmen or thinkers in that particular time and place. That's bold.
Let me mention, this is maybe a little bit on the other side of what we've been saying so far. Here's a statement by Madison about Montesquieu from 1792, that is a couple of years after the framing of the Constitution and the beginning of the new government. And in those years, Madison was beginning to go into opposition against the Federalist administration of Hamilton. He wrote a series of very short essays, one of which was on the topic spirit of governments, which turned out to be meant to be a correction, I'd say, of Montesquieu. That's how he understood it. So here's what he says about Montesquieu. And Paul, I'm interested to hear your reaction to it. He says, Montesquieu was in politics not a Newton or a Locke who established immortal systems, the one in matter, the other in mind, referring to Locke's essay on understanding. He, Montesquieu, was in his particular science what Bacon was in universal science. He lifted the veil from the venerable errors which enslaved opinion and pointed the way to those luminous truths of which he had but a glimpse himself. What do we make of that? Does that compromise his importance?
Yeah, it's subtle, as with many of Madison's points, that Montesquieu is fundamentally important, but not a specific guy, not a specific and trustworthy guide. I'm glad you brought this up, because I don't think we've mentioned Jefferson to this point in this conversation. Jefferson clearly knows Montesquieu well. We know that he made handwritten comments on 29 of the 31 books of the Spirit of Laws. So he read him in some detail, but Jefferson clearly turns away from Montesquieu as a monarchist. There's just too much in Montesquieu about decent government, moderate government coming from monarchical elements or the role of a nobility or his criticisms of democracy, democracy having a capacity to slide into anarchy. You can't really trust any authority. Jefferson says, this is not what America is about. This is not the way to apply or develop the ideas of the Declaration of Independence. And I think Madison follows him, the two of them are in agreement, whichever one of them comes up with it first, Madison and Jefferson, that they want to turn away from Montesquieu as a reliable guide for how to develop the 1787 Constitution, how to interpret it, how to bring the bare bones into real life. I would say in defense of Montesquieu, we to this day see the advantage of having balances, right? There's voice for popular views through local and state governments, through the House of Representatives, through a free press. But you know, certain kinds of questions in politics, don't you want a role for people who are not directly immediately responding to public opinion? You know, an executive whose primary responsibility is international affairs. We forget that about the presidency, right? National security, international affairs is job number one. Well, that they don't have to run for election the next year or even the second year. They can have a longer term. And even the complicated way that we elect them, not direct popular election of the president, but this more constitutional way of selecting the executive. And then the Senate having a six-year term and having different responsibilities than the popular House. This is the spirit of Montesquieu's constitutionalism, to say you can take some of those ideas that originate in monarchy, but you can apply them to a republic and make it more sustainable, more balanced. So you know, again, with Montesquieu, he thinks that blending is always better. We might criticize him for that, but you know, you can get the best of a different set of forms of government if you blend them and if you balance elements.
This is a good lead into a general description of what the founders take from Montesquieu, that Montesquieu provides a great model, but he needs to be democratized or republicanized, maybe a little bit better, that they're not happy with it, with him, to the degree that he accepts the British Constitution whole hog. It needs to be modified a bit more than he himself seemed to think. That was the American understanding of him. And I think in the context of the 1790s, they saw that particular aspect of Montesquieu was leading people like Hamilton, in their opinion, John Adams, in their opinion, leading them astray towards a more monarchical or a less democratic version of what the American regime or the American Constitution could be. So it's an interesting question about how one ought to interpret Montesquieu in the light of the American aspirations.
It's the large package that Montesquieu puts together does include elements that the Americans find a great advantage. I would say some of them we forget now as being a great advantage. For example, there's significant concern today that our whole political culture and our educational system, schools to universities, does not educate Americans to be citizens very well, does not educate us for citizenship. And we have complaints left and right about the loss of manners, a decency, a capacity to disagree in a civil way. All of that is in the package of Montesquieu's philosophy. I mentioned in earlier conversations we've had, the phrase at the very end of the Declaration of Independence, that we are fighting for our individual rights, a very Lockean idea, but to fight in this way, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. That's the kind of idea about virtues needed for government that's all throughout Montesquieu's philosophy. Now, if you're in a monarchy, you need these kinds of qualities or character. If you're in a republic, you need these kinds of civic virtues. So, you know, the whole package that Montesquieu gives is not purely democratic, because it does talk about these other elements that you need. It's good to have some bodies that are a little distant from immediate public opinion and public passions. And you do need to think about the education and the civic virtues that you need. So my own view is that it's indispensable for us to spend some time knowing about Montesquieu, because in a way he provides not just the hardware, you know, separation of powers and federalism, the institutional structure, he provides the software as well. And I think one problem we have right now is we're trying to run the hardware of a very complicated constitutional order without knowing very much at all about why and the sort of manners and mores and civic culture that you would need to properly operate the institutions.
That's a great point, I think.
Well, I think we can stop right there. That Michael, Professor Michael Zuckert said I made a great point. So I think my day is done.
I think we should, yeah. I don't know. Samantha, you have things you want to bring up?
Is there anything on Montesquieu that you two disagree on?
I think we disagree on how important Locke's philosophy is for Montesquieu, or Hobbes and Locke, how closely Montesquieu tracks Hobbes and Locke. So I'm of the view that we know that this minor nobleman in southwest of France is spending a lot of money on books. And we know he has Machiavelli's collected works, and we know he has Hobbes, and we know he has Locke. And so he's reading very widely in the Enlightenment. And then when it comes down to passages in any of his three big philosophical works, and then in The Spirit of Laws, how closely is he tracking, say, to Locke on the idea of security? The phrase that Montesquieu uses, security of individuals, tranquility and security of individuals, as the crucial definition of liberty. And that sounds a great deal like Locke. It has a psychological dimension that isn't maybe so foremost in Locke's formulation of it. But so that's one. But Michael, you go.
I would emphasize, I think to be very concise about it, you would emphasize moderation, which I think is obviously present, but not as central. And I would emphasize liberty, which I know you see as present, but perhaps not as central. So I think it would be moderation versus liberty, but it would be a matter of emphasis more than of real disagreement.
And then Michael is just mentioning, as you think about how fundamental Montesquieu is for American constitutionalism and law and politics, and the tragedy that we don't study Montesquieu in universities very much, even if you are a political science major or history major, philosophy major, let alone just general education. And so Montesquieu doesn't make it into the schools. We don't understand this important influence. But the debate about how to apply and interpret. So I think Michael is more sympathetic generally to Madison's conception of American constitutionalism. I'm a little more friendly to Hamilton and Washington, and seeing the advantages of the not so democratic elements of American politics, and also the emphasis on commerce, the commercial quality of an American republic, and to keep listing, the importance of a federal republic strong enough to defend itself and be a presence in international affairs. That's very Hamiltonian, Washingtonian, and it's clearly a presence in Montesquieu, and there's just not as much on that in Madison and Jefferson, or in Locke's philosophy. So this disagreement about which conception of American constitutional politics you think is generally better, and then how you interpret Montesquieu in relation to that.
Yeah.
How would you summarize how Montesquieu influenced legal history and the rule of law in America?
I think Americans are committed to the idea of separation of powers, and I think they're committed to that idea in a way related very, very closely to what Montesquieu had in mind, which was separation of powers is a way of guaranteeing rule of law, or at least of encouraging rule of law. And I think Americans remain committed to that, and that has been one of the mainstays, in fact, of American constitutionalism throughout our history. I'll leave it at that. I think that's the main thing. Although, one of the things that I believe to be true, and this fits with what Paul was saying earlier, we don't any longer read Montesquieu in the law schools, I don't think. And that to understand the major features of the American constitutional system, it would help not merely to read the Constitution, but to read the sources behind the Constitution, and especially including Montesquieu. It wouldn't necessarily require reading all 700 pages, but one could judiciously select things. And that I think lawyers, constitutional lawyers in particular, would be better trained if they understood what the Constitution was aiming to do in a Montesquieuian framework.
For university students and for law students to have at the foundation some Locke, some Montesquieu, some Blackstone drawing on both Locke and Montesquieu, and very influential, especially in Blackstone's case, for taking the broad phrases of the Constitution, and especially the brief and broad phrases of Article 3, and for the Americans to say, what does this really mean? How are we going to apply this? How are we going to operate it? I'll mention one other legal constitutional influence we talked about before. Right now, there are some elements of the, I'll call it the Montesquieuan complex constitutional order, that are very controversial. The Electoral College is very controversial. The Senate, operating in the spirit of the Senate with a filibuster, meaning the Senate as a non-majoritarian institution or a check on democratic majoritarianism. That's very controversial. At moments, the Supreme Court itself becomes controversial when we realize, gee, we've given a great deal of authority to a very small number of lawyers elevated to the bench. Those are all Montesquieuan elements of constitutionalism and the rule of law. I think they become more controversial and we get angrier. There's more heat than light, precisely because we don't. It's not that there aren't criticisms you can make of any of them, but we're less reasonable, less thoughtful, less informed in the criticisms we make and in the reforms we might want to propose, change those, because we don't study the Montesquieu and the Blackstone. We'd be better off right now for just a little bit more, anything more than we understand now.
Yeah, I would emphasize one aspect of what Paul said, which is, yes, understand the Montesquieuian inspiration or the Montesquieuian spirit maybe behind some of those practices, but also don't necessarily take them as authoritative. The Americans wanted to modify Montesquieu in various more democratic ways, and I think we should take that seriously as well.
You know, the trick, in a way, is to persuade people to not be so intimidated by a large book like The Spirit of Laws or the work that it takes to find, well, which of Locke's works would be the right source to look to for this. Or, the Commentaries on the Laws of England is in 4 volumes, a very big book. But to reconnect current political and policy debates with these original sources and say, you really ought to, you owe yourself a favor, do yourself a favor and do a little work on getting the grounding, which would include, as Michael just mentioned, all of the very serious American statesmen, lawyers and jurists, but more broadly, who are influenced by these philosophers and are arguing among themselves about just what is the way to fulfill the ideals and claims and rights of the Declaration of Independence, those principles of justice. And then the principles embedded in the Constitution, do they need to be amended and reformed? How do we actually operate them? Those are complicated questions, and it takes some homework. For current people in policy debates and public life, it takes some homework.
How would you summarize Montesquieu's influence on the founding documents, particularly the Constitution, the Bill of Rights?
There's a philosopher, recently deceased, Judith Schlar, who called Montesquieu the father of constitutions, that many liberal democracies or monarchies that were moderating themselves to be more complex constitutional monarchies looked to the Spirit of Laws. And I think he plays that role in the American constitutional order. I will borrow an analogy from George Washington. It's important for fathers to retire, to resign, and go, to let the children govern themselves. So this is very much the spirit of Montesquieu's philosophy, to lay out what he thought was a comprehensive and adequate political philosophy for moderate, decent modes of politics, but then to say, but statesmen in each particular place, legislators in each particular place must argue among themselves and decide for themselves what is the right set of laws given their culture and history and religion and climate and all of that?
I would say the following. The two main features of the American constitutional system, as I understand them anyway, are federalism and the separation of powers, and perhaps we'd say that add the Bill of Rights to that. And I would say all three of those are should be understood, properly understood, as modifications of Montesquieuian principles. And to understand them well would require understanding his original version of them and then the kind of changes that the Americans, and especially James Madison, because it turns out all three of those owe their present shape more to Madison, I think, than any other single person, to understand what those modifications came to and how valid or not they might be.
What would you say is the enduring influence of Montesquieu today?
Montesquieu emphasizes that a free form of politics needs the rule of law, and especially in the form of a complex constitutionalism, that we shouldn't simply equate democracy with liberty. You won't have true liberty in a sustainable, balanced, moderate way unless you have complicated institutions of law. And then, as part of the Montesquieu package, also what we would call today a culture, a political culture, he refers to it as civic virtues and mores and manners that help to operate and sustain that system of law. So that package of ideas is the American political order and his legacy. We just don't understand it very well anymore.
I would add, speaking of the enduring influence of Montesquieu, obviously there are the kind of things we've been talking about in the American constitutional system, but his enduring influence extends much farther than that, I think. So Montesquieu, among other things, introduces the main idea of what you might call sociology of law, or the main idea of a political sociology, that is of a sociological dimension to the study of politics. And that is tremendously important in modern political science and to some degree in modern legal studies. Montesquieu introduces a thicker notion of what political science involves, not just sociological considerations, but others as well, so that the development of the modern social sciences, for better or for worse, is to some large degree a product of Montesquieu's work. And that, again, is a big enduring influence of his work.
Thanks, guys. I think that's a wrap. A big thanks to Professor Carice and Professor Zuckert for joining me today. You can check out the film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders, Locke and Montesquieu, on YouTube, Facebook, or fedsoc.org. Thanks for listening, and check out our other podcasts on Google Play, iTunes, and Spotify, and look for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. Have a great day.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.